Support for today's episode of Script Apart comes from We Screenplay. If you just completed a draft of a script and are wondering what next, well, you need to check out We Screenplay. We Screenplay not only offers amazing free resources, like virtual events where your questions are answered by Hollywood's leading professionals, with incredible 72-hour turnaround, format-specific feedback tailored to your specific goals, and a price that no one else can come close to, We Screenplay coverage is used by thousands of writers in every phase of their careers, from emerging writers still finding their voice all the way to Oscar winners. So if your script is all ready to go, check out one of We Screenplay's labs, where dozens of writers have been repped, optioned, and staffed as a direct result of the real-life industry meetings and hands-on workshops offered by We Screenplay. Don't stay stuck. We Screenplay want to help. Check out We Screenplay by visiting wescreenplay.com or clicking the link in today's show notes. Support for this episode also comes from our friends at Screencraft. Breaking into Hollywood as an aspiring writer can be a confusing, convoluted thing. Fortunately, Screencraft is here to help writers with both the craft of writing and the business of Hollywood. Screencraft has everything for your writing journey, from video lectures starring your favorite writers to hands-on career coaching with their excellent writer development team. These guys offer the best screenwriting competitions designed to help your talent shine, featuring judges that really know their genre, from top literary reps to Oscar-winning screenwriters. Hundreds of past winners and finalists have started their careers with the direct support of Screencraft. Winners have been staffed on shows at Netflix, Amazon, Apple TV+, the list goes on. They've also sold scripts and been hired to write films for the likes of Universal, Lionsgate, Blumhouse, and Hulu. So if you're an aspiring writer, what are you waiting for? Don't wait to check out Screencraft today. Visit screencraft.org or click the link in today's show notes. Hey everyone, welcome back to another episode of Script Apart, a podcast about the first draft secrets of great movies and TV shows. My name's Al Horner, and usually on this show, I speak with an incredible screenwriter about their first draft of what went on to become a beloved film or episode of TV. This week, however, we are switching things up. Those who've been with us for a while might remember us testing out a new format for the show back in December 2022 called Script Club. The idea is simple. It's basically like a book club, but for screenplays. Instead of someone coming on the show to talk about a film or series that they themselves wrote, with Script Club, we invite a storyteller we admire to pick a film or show they love and discuss what makes it special. This second Script Club episode, following Pixar director Lee Unkrich's brilliant dissection of The Shining last time, is a long time coming, I'll admit, but more than worth the wait. And I say that because today's guest is one of my favourite contemporary authors, and she's here discussing one of my favourite films of the last 20 years too. Yes, this week on the show, the incredibly talented Carmen Maria Machado is here, discussing Alfonso Cuarón's Children of Men. Carmen is the Folio Prize-winning author of books like the astounding short story collection Her Body and Other Parties, and a ludicrously powerful memoir titled In the Dream House, excavating not only her own past, but the history of domestic violence in American society and media too. Whether it's fiction or non-fiction work of Carmen's you're reading, you can expect exciting experiments with form, frequent lapses into gothic horror, a beautiful spirit of queerness, and lines of prose that scream at you to pick up a pen and jot them in a notebook, lest you forget their truth and poetic flair. I had long suspected that Carmen might have a love for film and TV, as film and TV often pop up in her work, as a lens through which she and her characters see the world. In Her Body and Other Parties, for example, there's a brilliantly inventive story called Especially Heinous, which is told entirely in log lines for made-up episodes of Law and Order, each one contributing to a dark exploration of the way that pop culture fetishizes sexual violence towards women. In the Dream House, meanwhile, mentions everything from Finding Nemo to All About Eve. There's a great chapter in particular about the queer coding of Disney villains and Carmen's admiration for the way they insist on surviving in a world that hates them. All of which made me think that Carmen would be a fantastic guest to have on the show, and I was not wrong. I had suspected, in all honesty, that she'd choose Jennifer's Body by Diablo Cody as the film to talk about because she's written about her love for that script before. Instead, the Pennsylvanian-born writer chose a 2006 cult classic that rattles me more with each passing year. And I say that because the world it depicts is a world that I've kind of come to inherit as someone living under a British government that, in my opinion, is waging a sadistic war on asylum seekers as a distraction from its real problems. Based on a 1992 novel by P.D. James, Children of Men, co-written by Quaron with Timothy J. Sexton, David Arata, Mark Fergus and Hawk Ottsby, forecast a Britain in the mid-2020s on the brink of collapse, pushed into crisis by a global fertility problem. Starring Clive Owen and eerily ahead of its time, it really is an astonishing movie and one that Carmen had incredible insights on as a master storyteller and screenwriter herself. In the spoiler conversation that you're about to hear, she tells me what she finds so impactful about the tale and the influence it's had on stories of her own, such as 2017's Chilling Inventory, which I'll add a link to in today's show notes. We get into why the best storytellers, like Alfonso Cuarón, are the ones who are able to change your temperature, as Carmen puts it. We use Children of Men as a means of exploring the idea that apocalyptic fiction is an unveiling of a blueprint of how to avoid disaster. And of course, we analyse all the best scenes and character moments from the film, including, of course, its enigmatic ending. Thanks to Carmen for being such a fantastic guest. Thank you also to our Patreon community over at patreon.com/scriptapart for helping make this episode possible. And a quick announcement that if you are listening in London, if you are a Londoner, we are hosting a very special fourth birthday live episode on March 11th down at Picture House Central in Soho. We are going to be screening Alan Partridge, Alpha Papa, an all-time British comedy classic, if you ask me, and recording a live conversation with its co-writers Neil and Rob Gibbons right after. I'll put a link in today's show notes if you'd like to be there. Tickets are £12 and I really think it's going to be a great event. We'd love to see you there. Okay, that is all the admin out of the way. Let's jump straight into the episode. This is the fantastic Carmen Maria Machado discussing the first draft secrets of Children of Men on Script Club. Thanks everyone for tuning in. You're listening to Script Apart, hosted by me, Al Horner, produced by Camille Demet. Carmen, thank you so much for being here. I have been really excited for this conversation, in part because, you know, I'm a huge fan of your work, and I know a lot about the literary influences who've helped shape that voice. What I don't know so much about is your relationship with film and TV, despite it coming up quite a lot in your stories. Let's begin there. Are you a big movie person? Because it seems that you are from the amount that it comes up in your work.
I don't know. I guess it depends how you define big movie person. I mean, I am definitely not a film scholar by any stretch of the imagination, but I love movies. I love them so much that often when they're bad, I get really mad. So I have like a very, you know, I feel like when I go to a movie, I'm like, I'm always like, I should say, I guess when I was young, my parents, everybody would always complain that when they took me to the movies, we would leave and I would already be like, they would say complaining about it, but I was always just like thinking through like what I had just seen. And I feel like, yeah, like I really love television. I really love movies, and I think that like they inform my work, and like I studied photography in college, so I think I have like a real interest in like visual, sort of the visual medium. So yeah, I don't know, like I guess that's a very long answer to say yes, I would say I'm a movie person, not a scholar, but a movie person. Yeah,
when we talk about your style, like this kind of dreamy genre colliding style of yours, Carmen, I'm curious, are there filmmakers who kind of reached across mediums to help influence that storytelling style, or has that all been literary, the sort of influence, the culmination of things you've adopted into your work?
I mean, I think the people who, it's funny because I don't think this is true for all writers, and I suppose it's not even true for me as I'm saying it out loud, but like there was sort of a moment in my 20s when I had like almost like a leap forward in my process where I sort of identified a bunch of like kind of what, how I wanted to be writing, the kind of writers who inspired me. And I sort of read them all in one go. obviously I had work that influenced me from when I was a very young person, but I feel like thinking about myself as like a sort of, yeah, like a genre promiscuous writer who is writing these sort of lush, erotic, genre bendy horror stories, like that sort of started at this sort of very precise moment in my 20s. And I think in that moment, really what was sort of driving me along were writers like Kelly Link and George Saunders and Helen Oyeyemi and Karen Russell and Shirley Jackson and Angela Carter. And I mean, you know, and so on and so on. But I definitely can feel when a movie or a filmmaker is like influencing me. Like, just as an example, I remember very clearly the first time I saw Peter Strickland's, oh my God, the title's going to escape me now. This is terrible. Duke of Burgundy.
That's okay. The one. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Yes. The first time I saw Peter Strickland, the Duke of Burgundy, I remember being so interested in like world building techniques that he was using. I mean, I was interested in the entire film for all kinds of reasons, but like there was something precise about the world building that like really stuck with me. Or I remember seeing also in grad school, Peter Strickland I saw later, the Duke of Burgundy I saw later, but I also remember seeing like Holy Motors when I was in grad school, which was another one that like visually, I just felt like there was like a lot of stuff about structure and like visual storytelling that really like caught me and like really felt precise and important. God help me, like Lars von Trier, like I also remember distinctly seeing Melancholy. I've seen like all of his movies or almost all of them, and ever since I was like a teenager, but I also remember seeing like Melancholia and being like very caught by it in this very precise way. So I think that sometimes I just see a movie and my brain does this thing where I'm actually trying to translate what's happening on the screen to like it's basically like, how can I do this but in a story? like how can I sort of take some effect that's happening and use it to my own ends? Which is sort of a thing I do when I read as well, but I think with movies I'm like, you know, I'm never going to be like a director. That's not like, you know, in the cards for me, but I think I'm really curious about like how I can adapt stuff that I'm seeing on the screen that interests me in sort of a literary way or like in terms of thinking about prose.
A lot of the films you just mentioned there, and indeed the film that you picked to discuss today, they remind me of a phrase that you used a couple of years ago in an interview I heard about a story's capacity to change your temperature and how it's not necessarily, well, this was my interpretation of that phrase, so correct me if I'm wrong, but it felt like what you were trying to convey was it's not necessarily about liking a story or liking characters. It's about kind of invoking a reaction. And sometimes that reaction is horror. Sometimes it's repulsion. Whatever it is, the important thing is to change the temperature of your audience and to make them feel something. That's obviously something that's important across your own work. And yeah, I'd love to hear a bit more about your relationship with that phrase and also how you kind of approach crossing that threshold in your own work. Like, how do you test a story to make sure that it's doing that, Carmen?
Ooh, well, that second question is much harder. I think, yeah, so the phrase, this is a phrase that I use, which I feel like an interviewer used it once to describe my work. And I was also completely taken with this phrase and have used it ever since. But, you know, I think that like, I mean, I'm also a teacher, which I feel like it's sort of hard to like extract like me talking about craft or like my own work or whatever from teaching. And oftentimes in teaching, I have to say some variation of like, whether or not you like something is not really relevant for the purposes of this class, whether it's, you know, a writing workshop or even like a literary conversation about like about a book, you know, it's like liking it is, I mean, it's fine if you like it or don't like it. It's not really important to in terms of how we talk about this and like what it does. And I think that sometimes you can like not like something or like find it incredibly unpleasant and also have your temperature altered. So like, going like Melancholia is a great example of that, where I don't even want to even like articulate the depths of despair that movie like dragged me down to, but it certainly changed my certainly altered my temperature. And I think that like, you know, that is what art does, is it taps into human consciousness and like attempts to alter it or like touch it or affect it in some way. And I think that, like, that to me is what good art does. And it's what sort of distinguishes what I would call art from, like, related but non-artistic endeavors. So I feel like for me, there's just something about, yeah, I've been, like, altered and changed in some way, even for the briefest of moments, right? And I think that's just, like, that to me is the most interesting thing. And then, yeah, it doesn't really have anything to do with, like, liking or not liking something.
So would you care to introduce the temperature-changing film that we're discussing today that you've chosen for this podcast?
Yes. I chose Children of Men by Alfonso Cuarón, who is a director whose work I have always really admired, and someone who I rewatched the movie last night, and I was explaining it to my girlfriend, had not seen it, and I made her watch it with me, and I was like, you know, just talking the whole time about, like, how good this was. Like, I was just like, oh, look at that shot, or wait, I, like, paused at some point, I was like, we're gonna go back. It's a movie that, like, has just had, like, I've watched it probably more than I've watched most other films in my life, except for, like, my comfort films. I would not call this a comfort film. There are certain comfort films that I've seen, like, probably 100+ times. This one I've seen probably, like, 50 times, but every time I watch it, I get something new out of it. And it's a movie that I saw as a young person, or I guess in my, like, 20s, and it changed my temperature, I think, kind of forever, and I think affected even the way that I write and the way I think about storytelling.
That's really interesting. So much to dig into there. First thing I will say is, you mentioned your relationship with Cuarón's work goes back. In the Dream House, you mention a friend of yours called Adam, who worked at a local movie theater, and you guys together would watch the movies that you couldn't watch at home. And you mention Y Tu Mama Tambien as one of them. So was that the sort of introduction to Alfonso's work? Was that the beginning of this relationship?
Yes, actually, she goes by Anna now, but yes, Anna was the person who introduced me to a lot of movies. A lot of the filmmakers I've just mentioned, in fact, we also watched Dancer in the Dark was, like, a movie that she introduced me to. And we watched, like, David Lynch together, like Mulholland Drive was a movie that we saw together. So yeah, like, this was a person who had really great taste in movies. And when I was, you know, sort of, and also, like, great taste in music and great taste in a lot of things. And so while I was sort of flailing around trying to figure out what I liked and what spoke to me, she was just like, we're gonna watch a ton of movies. And yeah, she worked at this movie theater and would bring home day-old popcorn and garbage bags, and we would just sit in her basement and just watch movies, like, endlessly. And it was something that, like, it was a really important moment in my life, because I think it gave me space, because I don't know, like, I'd always read really vigorously as a child, but my mom was always sort of like, I mean, she sort of monitored what I read and would occasionally, like, intervene. And we actually, there were really strict rules in my house about, like, what kinds of movies we could watch. So, like, I was not allowed to watch a rated R movie. I mean, it was just like strict is not really the word I would use, but there was just a lot of, like, rules around that sort of thing. And so getting to go to someone's house and see, like, Mulholland Drive, which I, like, absolutely would not have been allowed to watch at home, but getting to see it was, like, a really special. And yeah, so Y Tu Mama Tambien was, like, one of those movies. And it was a movie that I think pricked a lot of sort of places in me, because it was this, like, sort of, like, erotic film, which I think was also, like, really important to me, and, like, developing language for, like, the erotics in art. That was, like, the beginning of that process. It was a film that did stuff with, like, narration and the eye of the camera that I at the time did not really have language for, but, like, could sense that there was something kind of special and strange happening. And it was also a movie that is really, like, sort of emotionally devastating in this, like, really specific kind of way. And I think that, like, it was just, and I remember thinking watching it that I had never seen anything like it before. So yeah. And then, of course, every time he had a new movie out, it was always something wildly different. And when I, like, eventually looked him up, I was like, oh, he's directed, like, so many things that are all so different from each other, which is also a
Harry Potter.
Harry the third, the only decent Harry Potter movie is directed by him. I mean, I don't know if this is controversial. I don't actually know, like, but, like, obviously the Harry Potter movies, like, are mostly absolutely terrible. But, like, the third one is, like, really dark and interesting in this way that the others are not. And I remember, like, even seeing it in theaters, I was like, this feels different. And then I realized he had directed it, and I was like, oh, that makes sense. Or like A Little Princess, which is a movie that I was very obsessed with as a child. And when I got to be an adult and like realized that he'd also directed that movie, I was like, wait, that makes sense somehow. Like, even though, again, like it's so different in tone. He's just such an interesting director. And I think that like, I'm interested not just in Children of Men and his other individual films, but just like, and I never say this word right. Is it oeuvre? I always say oeuvre, but I don't think that's correct. Is that correct?
I chicken out and say canon or something like that. Okay.
Well, in any case, his body of work, like, as sort of a whole thing, is just like so interesting. And I find that kind of willingness to experiment and willingness to like move into these new spaces and like push into these new, like, I just find that like really interesting. And I feel like whenever I really, really love like a director or an author, it's oftentimes authors who like, or directors or people, artists who like everything they do is like a little different, and they're always kind of clearly trying out new things. And I don't know, I just find that really interesting.
It's interesting hearing you talk about how Itumama Tambien pricked, as you say, like certain interests for you that are currently in your work. Like, there are overlaps between, I would say, Itumama Tambien and elements of what you do, Carmen, much less so at first glance with Children of Men. Or so I thought until I started to look a bit closer. And then there are certain kind of overlaps that I picked out, but I'll throw it over to you first. Like, when you talk about this being one of your most rewatched films, well, first of all, why is that, Carmen? And secondly, do you think across all those rewatches, there are parts of this movie and its message that through osmosis you've soaked up into your own work at all?
I mean, I think part of the reason, I was having this thought last night rewatching it, because I think part of the reason this movie spoke to me and continues to speak to me is it also, I feel like it captures like a moment in time, which I think of as being like a young person in the aughts. So a person who has like seen 9/11 and then seen the way the world has like kind of unfurled and the way that like the political response to this like terrorist action really sent us on like a dark path that we're still on. And deep into. And I think that like the visual sort of references that are happening, which are almost like too many to even name. And I feel like whenever I rewatch it, I see new things that I didn't notice before. I think there's something about like thinking about like how a story of a dystopia is a story about the now, right? So it's like both a story that's, you know, there's like stuff that doesn't exist now, like these like suicide kits and these like, you know, certain kinds of technology that like it looks a little new, but the story is so rooted like in the moment that it was created and the moment that like this person, this filmmaker, could sort of see the way that like the political sort of realities of, you know, 2006 or whenever the movie, it was 2006 when the movie came out, the way that that informs a dystopian sort of vision of like what it will be like. And I noticed also on this watch, you know, we're currently in year 2023. The year of the film is 2027. So we're like, you know, we're like not that far away. Yeah. And I'm sure like in 2006, it would have looked like so far away. And now I'm like, man, 2027 is like, I mean, it's far, but it's not that far. Like that's, yeah, you know, that's going to be in a couple of years. Like, and you know, I think that like, I don't know. And the film just has this like had this predictive quality that I also found very interesting. Like, I only noticed on this watch that they mentioned that there was like the protagonist's son died in a flu epidemic in 2008. And I was like, oh, there was a swine flu epidemic in 2009, like, which was after the movie came out, but of course before it happened. So there's just like these interesting sort of details and these things that have sort of come true. And I don't know, like there's just something about it that I think this way of seeing, yeah, like seeing the future or seeing something else that exists outside of a reality, but knowing that those things are always rooted in reality. And I think that like, I mean, we can talk about this in more detail, but like a story of mine that I think was very directly sort of influenced by this film is a story called Inventory, which is in my first collection, which we can talk about.
I had wondered. Yeah.
Yeah. And I can talk, I have a lot of thoughts about how that this movie and that story kind of connect. But I it also was funny because when COVID started, I remember there were like a handful of writers who kept getting interview requests because they had written work that seemed to almost like quote unquote predict this thing we were in, like Ling Ma's novel Severance, which is also like uncannily very, very close. And there were a few others. And of course, like my story inventory kept coming up. And so I kept getting asked about it. And eventually I was like, well, you know, like no one actually can see the future. I think all you have to do is that if you're paying sort of close attention to what's going on around you and you have a bit of an imagination, like it's actually not that hard to like write stuff that quote unquote predicts things that are coming, because if you're, yeah, if you're just paying attention, like that's sort of the reality of it. And so it just feels like it's a movie that is making a point, but is also paying attention and feels like predictive in this way that I think good science fiction does.
Yeah, the predictive thing is really interesting because, I mean, we are having this conversation the week that the British Home Secretary stood up and warned of a hurricane of immigrants coming to our shores, claiming multiculturalism has failed and calling for the abolishment of the Human Rights Act. So, you know, there's rhetoric in the air right now that seems pulled straight from Children of Men. There are multiple ways in which the real world has drifted into a state that resembles elements of the film. But yeah, inventory, I'm so glad you mentioned it, because there is a slow trudge towards apocalypse that we experience as an audience in this movie, rather than the kind of sprint into oblivion that we so often see in these types of films. So the Danny Boyle movie, 28 Days Later, is like a good comparison. Like on screen in that movie, as in so many other movies of this ilk, we see this kind of very fast societal disintegration, Rome falling practically overnight. The story told in Children of Men is one in which an infertility crisis has already been raging for decades when we meet Theo and these characters. There have been all these kind of knock-on effects to that crisis that have resulted in this like global unraveling, but it's been quite glacial. And that is certainly the case in Inventory, which for anyone who hasn't read it, it kind of spans an entire lifetime of romantic and sexual crusades for one woman caught in the middle of it. I hope that's not too reductive a description of the story.
No, I'd say that's accurate. Yeah.
Can you tell me about the connective tissue there between the two?
Sure. I mean, so I think that I will say the origin of that story is sheer pettiness, because I got into an argument with somebody in a writing workshop where it's not even worth getting into the details, but basically they implied that I didn't like work that had sex in it, which was so strange because I'd obviously spent like at that point my entire grad school career thinking about sort of the role of sex in fiction. And it's, if you know my work, the idea that I don't like it is quite funny because I like include it constantly. It's like probably one of the most defining features of my writing. And so I was like, I'm going to write a story that's entirely made of sex scenes. And that was my goal. And of course, pretty quickly, I was like, well, it can't just be that. Like, there has to be something else happening around it, or the story, it's just, you know, whatever. And I don't exactly know what sort of led me to the idea of there being a pandemic in the background. But I sort of got the idea. I was like, oh, like, of course, if you were sort of trying to live your life, have sex, date, do whatever you're doing the way that we all do. And also there's this creeping apocalypse in the background, but creeping is sort of the key. So like you said, and I actually love that observation. It's like, yeah, a lot of sort of dystopian world's end films describe like a very quick collapse, which I think is narratively, there's like narrative reasons for that. But I agree that Children of Men, it both shows something more interesting and I think more accurate. And I think that if you think of the world ending as being like a thing that will happen so fast that you'll be like, oh my god, the world ended, like that you're gonna miss how the world is slowly ending like right now, like as we speak. And I think about, I mean, especially like even this summer, like I feel like all summer I was just in this like crisis of like, you know, they're like hottest June on record, hottest July on record, hottest August on record, hottest September. And I've just been like, I know the movie I'm in. I'm not in 28 Days Later. I'm in Children of Men. Like, I'm in this world where, like, we're in a moment of crisis. The government has, of course, moved to this, like, very far right-wing space. Like, and not just my government, the U.S. government, but governments across the world. And we are in this moment of, like, absolute crisis. And, like, this is how the world ends, not with a bang, but a whimper, right? And so I think that this idea of like people trying to like go to coffee shops and go to their stupid jobs and, you know, doing the things that you do while everything is sort of collapsing around you is a really, it feels like just more accurate. And yeah, just trying to live your stupid life. And I remember also thinking about this a lot during COVID when I was like, I have to go take a walk today because I am just trapped in this, like, it's like I, you know, I'm just in my house and I need to like do, you know, and I'm just like trying to like keep my brain alive during this like moment of like lockdown and stagnation. And thinking how strange it is to just like kind of be existing and trying to live your life when the world is slowly collapsing around you. And also to be clear that like neither of those things are, like, I think that it's easy to be like, well, how could you do X, Y, Z when like everything is falling apart? And it's like, well, what else can you do? Like, you do have to like wake up and make coffee and go to your job and like, you know, talk to your, you know, or like whatever. You'd like, do you have to, like do these things in your life because that's just how it is. But also there's always going to be this like sort of slow moving thing happening in the background. And I think that like that movie sort of thematically has a lot of like backgrounding and foregrounding that's happening that spoke to that story, and also a lot of literal backgrounding and foregrounding, because obviously one of the techniques of the film is that like there's all this world building happening, but it's in the graffiti and the newspapers and the television screens, and you're sort of getting all this stuff,
the billboards, the bus posters,
totally. So you also, and that is like a, and that's a feature, like that kind of storytelling where there's all this stuff, that's a very much like a distinct feature of film that I really like. Like, I like when I watch a movie and I'm able to look anywhere I please. And so whenever I see a movie multiple times, I can look in other places and like notice details that I didn't notice before. And this movie like allows that. There's so much richness and so much reward in like looking not where the action is and in the movement, in the shot, but like looking somewhere else. And I just think, yeah, just thinking about that foregrounding and backgrounding, I was like, how can I do like a prose version of that? Like, how do I think about that in a storytelling form? And so I end up with this story where, yeah, a woman is just like, you know, talking about all the sex she's having and all the, you know, mostly just sex, not really, I would call it dating exactly. She's having a lot of sex, but also like things are collapsing around her. And she's both trying to like survive this huge thing and also just trying to like live her life. And to me, it just feels like the truest, again, like a true sort of version of dystopia, truer than like an overnight collapse or whatever.
And to zoom out and talk a bit about like just your wider proclivity towards apocalyptic fiction, the Greek translation of apocalypse, I believe, is unveiling. And I learned that recently, and I love that because it speaks to what I think I love about apocalyptic fiction, which is, in writing about our worst tomorrow, there's something that might be unveiled about our anxieties today, and there's often something unveiled about how we might fix it too. Like a blueprint emerges for, you know, by virtue of the apocalyptic novel or the apocalyptic movie being what not to do, we might learn what to do. How does that resonate with what you love about consuming apocalyptic stories like Children of Men and, of course, writing them, Carmen? Is that kind of along the lines of what you love about it, about the sort of microgenre, or is there something else?
I don't know. That's so interesting, thinking about it as containing. See, I feel like when you said unveiling, I was like, oh, yes, unveiling how our follies have led us here. But you're like, no, unveiling a blueprint for how we might solve it. I was like,
glass half full over here.
Yeah, I was going to say that might feel like a difference in our personalities. Because I'm just like, I don't know if I agree. I mean, I think certainly it depends on the story. But no, I sort of imagine it being a kind of clarity. Like, it's a clarity about what is wrong with us. And I think that, like, I don't know. I mean, I'm sure you also feel this way, but I feel like when I think about like the dysfunction in my own government, and I don't even mean like, I mean, right now it's like very weird, but like I have felt unsafe and untrusting of my government since, I think probably since I was like a teenager. And I, you know, I sort of distinctly remember, I mean, I was like a college student in the Bush years. And I think that like, sort of recognizing that like it's never going to be normal again, that the people who have power will fight to retain it and will do things to retain it, and that the government is not there to like protect me or anyone like me or even people that are not like me, like that it only is really there to protect sort of wealthy, powerful interests. This is another reason that I feel like Children of Men spoke to me so much, was it really did like articulate sort of what I was seeing, but it was like really like a very like, you know, it's like he's just sort of saying like, this is where we're going. And it has this like clarity to it and this like understanding of like, you know, xenophobic policies, for example, like post 9/11, whatever, or, you know, the way that we, in the name of safety and protection, will like do like unspeakable horrors. And I think that like, I've always felt very helpless in the face of that. And I mean, I think that an artist's job, well, artists have lots of jobs. I think pricking the human consciousness is really sort of the one of the central jobs. But I think also this ability to like clearly show, like be like, I can see clearly what's happening here and I want to like show it to you or demonstrate it to you. And I think that like part of an artist's job, I think of it as like the hand on the chin that's like pointing someone's face. It's like, do you see what I see? Like, do you understand what I understand? And yeah, I think that like this film like has that power. And I think that like often apocalyptic stories have that power. So like to go back to 28 Days Later, which I mean, I agree that sort of sudden collapse is not realistic, but I mean, it's not realistic because it's zombies, but also it's not realistic because it's fast. I agree. But also I think that movie also has its own point about sort of like men and monsters, right? And like, you know, there's like that really great scene in the film where they are rescued, quote unquote, by humans that are uninfected. And at some point it becomes clear that the humans are far more dangerous than the zombies. And I think that's like, it's like a little bit of an obvious point, but it's a great point, you know? And I think there's a clarity there about, you know, and I think that like during COVID, I was thinking a lot about that because I was thinking about how like, obviously we have a monster in this case, we have this disease, we have this sort of unthinking, advancing thing that is like endangering everybody. And then we also have people at their literal absolute worst doing their literal absolute worst. And like, what is more dangerous? It's like, they're just dangerous in different ways, you know? And so, yeah, I think that like, for me, it's more of a clarity. I don't think of it as a blueprint for solving it. I think it's just like a clarity of like what's going on in the face of like helplessness and in the face of powers that you can't control.
28 Days Later is an interesting one. I mean, I guess to test my own thesis a little bit, the blueprint for how to avoid disaster in that film is, well, I guess it's don't mess with monkeys, right? Don't give a rage virus to a monkey. It's not going to end well for us.
Yeah. But like, the thing is that like, I actually don't fully remember like that, but like, I just feel like, but like, it's never as simple as like, don't do this one thing, because it's like, the thing is happening because of like massive policies that have been put in place and like, you know, decades or longer, like patterns that exist in the human race. So it's like, it's never as simple as like, don't do that one thing. It's like, don't do the thing that's been happening for 40 years or 100 years or 10,000 years. So like, you know, and it just feels like you're like, how can we even begin to get out of this? Because like, we're already doing it. And it's like, I think this is why the climate thing feels so specific, because it's like literally so big, you can hardly conceive of it. Like the idea of the climate, which is just like, it's just so huge. And it's like, and you are literally like, no individual person or even lots of people can like shift it. It's like the result of like policies that have been in place for a long time. And also like the human gestures toward progress that have happened in the Industrial Revolution. Like you're literally like going so far back in time. It's like, how can you even begin to like steer the ship in any other direction? Which I think is why I feel so like cynical about it all. But anyway.
That brings us on to something that I've definitely been thinking a lot about recently. Children of Men, like so much other great apocalyptic fiction, it takes a disaster or this kind of looming disaster, and it uses that as the nudge that humanity needs to indulge every single one of its worst tendencies. Like, you know, when you sit down and think about it, the infertility crisis in this movie, it doesn't inherently have to mean the kind of cascading other problems that follow. And yeah, I guess like I've been thinking a lot about what it says about human nature and what it says about the inclinations of man. It's obviously very pointed, this story being called Children of Men. It's about the nature of man, our proclivities towards violence. We are absolutely seeing that nudge in real time right now with the climate crisis, for example. We also saw it in COVID. Have those things changed your relationship with Children of Men or your understanding of this story in the years since you first watched it, Carmen?
I mean, it's so funny because I haven't watched it in a few years. It's been a minute since I've watched it. And when I was rewatching it last night, I remember noticing that the piece of it that felt the most, where I literally turned to my girlfriend, I was like, is this going to be us? Was like all the scenes with Jasper in the house in the woods. And they're just like smoking weed and listening to music and eating food. And he's like, yeah, you know, I sell weed to the whatever. Like, he's just like trying to live out those final days with this woman he loves and, you know, the few people around him. And that's it. And like, I was like, I don't know. And then maybe that's like a really cynical thing to say, because like, you want to be like, I don't know. Like, it's like, do you want to try and fight it? And I think that Theo is such an interesting character because he's like this very jaded figure who is having, you know, this like former activist who obviously like fell into this like hole of grief and like is now having like a fire lit under him again to like do the right thing to like solve, you know, this thing with humanity. I think what makes it so interesting is that the movie, obviously with the character of Key, this like pregnant woman, the first pregnant woman in, you know, almost two decades, is that it does create this like focal point where it's like, he's not just like a random activist suddenly reinvigorated to do activism. It's like, it's happening around this extremely specific thing that is like, we have not had a pregnant woman in 20 years. We suddenly have a pregnant woman. And he's like, I can do this. I can like, and I think that I can imagine feeling like it's like interesting because it's like, what is the equivalent of that in like any current moment that we're in? It's like, I can't really think of like a meta, like I'm not even sure that it really works. It's just such a specific sort of thing. And sorry, I'm also like thinking back to your last question, which I know we just finished talking about it, but I'm also thinking about the way this question of blueprint, and I'm thinking about how during COVID, like a thing that what was happening, I mean, I don't know what it was like in the UK, but like in the US, like there obviously were these policies that were put in place to help protect people. There was like, people were given stimulus checks, people were like rents were paused temporarily, student loans were paused. Like, there were all these things that like these policies put into place that like made people's lives better. Like, people like child poverty went down because we were giving money to families. And like, there was all these things that were happening. And it was like, and we had this moment of thinking about things like public health and universal basic income and like all these ideas, or like, you know, healthcare, like all these things that could have been a blueprint for a new world. And then the second it was quote unquote over, which is not over, but like, as you know, we like rolled it all back. We were like, never mind, never mind. Like, we literally had, like, we were talking about how much these policies, even in the middle of this crisis, were making people's lives better. And then we like couldn't even stick to that for like any real period of time. And so I think that like, yeah, like there's something about this watch where I was just thinking like, man, like, I just feel like my heart is just like, or my mind is like, I'm like, yeah, like, why wouldn't you just smoke weed and eat food and listen to music at the end of the world? Because like, what else could you possibly do? I suppose unless you had like a single specific thing that you only you could do, which is like basically what the movie is setting him up for. It's like, only Theo can get her safely to where they have to go. And that is humanity's hope. And it's such a like a perfect little it's the word I'm looking for. Like, it's almost like a quest in a it's like the ring. It's like in Lord of the Rings. It's like here's the ring. Only you can take the ring to the place. I call upon you to do this thing, and you know, whatever. And I've again forgotten your question because I'm just so caught up in it. So like, did I answer it?
You did. Get anywhere you did, close? Yeah. Well, there are two responses I have to that. Is just briefly on the topic of Jasper, what a gift he is to this film, because in a movie that could be like very heavy, the way Michael Caine calls everyone amigo is just so delightful that it immediately adds a bit of levity. I know I've been kind of fighting the temptation to call everyone amigo in the 24 hours since I rewatched this movie. The other thing to say is like, I love stories where the kind of wider mission that the kind of quote unquote hero has to embark upon, it's also the kind of mission that they need for themselves and for their kind of interior conflict. There isn't a huge amount of like screen time devoted to Theo and his personal life and the demons that he's fighting, but there's enough sprinkled in for you to realize that here is a man who, reflective of a wider societal shift towards nihilism and resignation, here is someone who has to rediscover hope and has to rediscover like an impulse to fight that he used to have because he used to be an activist, and it was something he let go of because of grief. I really love that character, and I think like I'm always impressed by blockbusters to whatever degree you'd call this a blockbuster, where the character work seems to be that rich, despite all the other kind of obligations they have in terms of spectacle.
Yeah. I mean, I think you're right about him. And like, I mean, I guess it is, it's funny. I was rewatched it last night, and that moment at the end, it's like, I've seen this movie so many times that I know the boat comes, but I feel like I'm always waiting for the movie to cut to the Children of Men title screen before the boat comes. Like, I feel like in my mind, I'm like, they also could just be out there and nothing happens. They could just be floating in the water. And like, but like there is this like gesture of hope, right? Which is that we see the tomorrow, like cutting through the fog. Even though Theo is dead, though I read somewhere that like, he's just unconscious. I'm like, he's dead, right? Like he's supposed to be dead. Yeah. I think he's dead. He's not just unconscious. But like, yeah, like I feel like this moment, the film is ultimately hopeful, which I think is like a really, its own kind of bold move, right? I think, I don't know. I feel like if I had made this movie, I would have ended with just them like floating in the water in the fog, and that would have been like the end. But yeah, no, you're right that like the film is ultimately hopeful, and I think right, like it's because like Theo's external journey and internal journey are like tied so closely together, and it's like, yeah, like he is. It's like ultimately this decision by the filmmaker to like think of, even with his death, it's like a death of a man redeemed and a man who has like found this little bit of hope when he thought that it was all extinguished, which is really beautiful. Yeah, it's a beautiful gesture, and it's a gesture of a certain very specific kind of filmmaker, which I really love.
And the poignancy of the rowboat, the sort of symbolism of the rowboat in a movie about immigration, or in part about immigration, I find that so poetic. It's literally hope kept afloat. And yeah, it's interesting though. I think we have slightly different readings of the ending, where for me, it's so complicated, where it is like a redemption of sorts. And it is like, there is heroism to it. And there is a note of triumph to the fact that Theo has essentially succeeded in his quest. He's got Key and her baby to safety. But the glory of it that you would normally see at this moment in a big Hollywood feature, it's kind of tempered by the fact like we have just seen the worst depravities of man. And to me, it's interesting watching that film, depending on the mindset I'm in and depending on my like pessimism versus optimism and where I'm at in terms of that, where that needle is pointing in me. When I watched it last night, the kind of flicker of hope that we get from seeing Key and her baby reach salvation,
yeah,
it kind of has to coexist with the question of whether or not humanity deserves to survive. Like the barbarity that we've just seen kind of makes it's hard to extinguish in your head. But yeah, that ending, it is really special. Can you remember the first time you saw it, like the sort of lump in your throat that it left, if that indeed was your reaction?
I mean, I remember not knowing if the boat was going to show up. I remember thinking, like having this thought of like, oh my God, what if they're just floating in the water? They're floating by this buoy and the boat never appears. I think that the movie is meant, it's obviously we're meant to have that tension, because like there's that line, there's that conversation between the midwife and Theo, like towards the end where she's explaining what the mirrors, and he's like, you've never directly spoken to these people. Like I'm just getting like a person, like a game of telephone basically. And she's like, yep. And you're like, oh my God, right? Like it's possible that it'll be floating out there forever. And especially because they've just bombed the like refugee camp behind them. So it's like, she's just, you know, it's like she has nowhere else to go, but like to this place. And what if it doesn't show up? And I remember being really nervous. And I think like, you know, especially when I was younger, I think when I was learning how to watch movies or learning about like language of movies, especially movies like horror movies or like movies, darker sort of films, like learning about like what the ending, various techniques that filmmakers use in terms of endings, in terms of like resolving tension or leaving it open or seemingly resolving it and then and then going to the side, like, you know, like the sort of classic, like, you know, the killer is dead, then his hand twitches and the movie's over, you know, like that sort of like gesture of like, we've resolved it, it's fine. Oh, actually, there's still a threat. It's ongoing. It's leaving room for a sequel, whatever, you know, whatever's actually happening there. And so I think I was sort of like wondering what would happen and wondering, yeah, like what was coming. And to me, I do, yeah, I guess like, yeah, I do. I think the boat appearing is a hopeful gesture. I think you're totally right that like, and obviously, luckily, thank God there's no sequel. Thank God no one tried, you know? But like, I think that like, you're right that like, for all we know, she gets on the Tomorrow and it's like that whole scene in 28 Days Later where like they're with the military and actually it's quite dangerous. Or those guys in that building, whatever they are, they're like soldiers or ex-soldiers. And then suddenly man is even more dangerous than this other thing. So like, yeah, it's possible that's what it is. But I think that like, that image, like that final sort of like, I don't know. I think the child being a girl is part of that as well. Like this sense of hope and the sense of like, there could be something else and we could do better. And like key, because of this person, like he is able to like, and also her own sort of strength and her own resilience is like able to like, maybe take the next step and maybe not. Maybe she gets on that boat, they steal her baby and they shoot her and throw her off the side. I don't know. But I do think that it is like such an interesting gesture. And I think that like I said, if I had made this movie, the boat would probably not have showed up. It would have just been her drifting in the fog.
Yeah.
And that would have been where it ended. But I think that's my own pessimism. You know? So, I don't know. I think Quarantine, I love it. I think it's like a really, again, it's like, it feels like the vision and the perspective of like a very specific person.
You mentioned there how it's especially poignant that it's a girl that Theo is made the custodian of. In the P.D. James novel, I think it's Julianne Moore's character, Julian, who's pregnant, rather than it being this young girl. There are quite a lot of pronounced changes from the novel, that being one of them. Had you read the book, Carmen, before you saw the film? Have you read it since? Tell me about your relationship with the novel.
No, I have not. I know about it. At some point, I think I went to go read it and realized it was so different from the film that I never actually read it. But I do know that like in the film or in the novel, the crisis of infertility, which I feel like is not stated outright in the movie, is that men, like sperm does not exist anymore. Like sperm has just died off. So it's not that women can't get pregnant. It's that there isn't sperm to get them pregnant. And also I think crucially in the book, it's a boy that's born. And this, I'm assuming this has to do with like this question of like, is humanity going to like, yeah. So I think there's like something, but I haven't read it, so I actually don't know.
Yeah. Well, me neither, sadly, but the, I don't know. I love the idea of that because there's something so true about the fragility of male ego that like men being the ones who are, you know, medically now inferior or whatever you want to call it, like that would result in the violence that we see in the world and all sorts. It's yeah, it is fascinating. What one other kind of big difference in the book, there's not really much of the kind of whole road trip element of Cuaron's movie, and I was thinking about that, and I remembered that some of my favorite passages of yours involve road trips, and I especially love The Resident, which, yeah, is one of my favorite short stories of yours. So many of my favorite pages within that story are sort of set on the road. Road trips obviously punctuate in The Dream House as well, because it's an element of Children of Men I love, and I realize the degree to which there are so many cinematic road trips that I adore. I'm curious, like, what do you think it is that works so fantastically about road trips, both on the page and on screen? Like, do you think it's the kineticism of them, like the kind of movement of going from one place to the other, taking our characters both physically and metaphorically out of their normal surroundings? Or, yeah, what do you think it is, Carmen, as someone who's written some great road trips on in fiction and nonfiction form?
This is such a great question. And I'm suddenly realizing, and I'm thinking, obviously, Children of Men is set in the UK. So they're doing a road trip in the UK, but the road trip has like utility. Like they're not just like randomly on the road, right? Like they has a function. And I think that like the road trip as it exists in like the American psyche is like so distinct because the US is so freaking huge and like you can drive for days and days and not even be halfway across it. Like it's so big. And there are so many sort of distinguished, like every part of the country is so different and you can sort of reach these like aesthetically, culturally specific and different places by being on the road. And I think so much of American culture is centers around cars and highways, and this has been like just a huge part of like I think the American psyche for like forever, right? And so I think part of it is that is so interesting, and I imagine that there's like some kind of like almost like this sort of artistic export of the US that like maybe accounts for like the presence of the road trip and even in non-American films. But I don't know. I think, yeah, they're interesting. You can sort of, anything can happen, like a plot, like, you know, you can like blow a tire, drive into a bad town, stop at a diner, like encounter a stranger, you know, like there's something about it that's so like, like you can kind of accommodate almost any plot you can imagine. Even something like Lolita, right? Which is like, Lolita is a road trip. I mean, a huge chunk of that novel is a road trip. And so like it has this sort of quality of like giving you almost like surveying sort of visually a lot of different space, and like also kind of being like, you know, connect characters. So like obviously in this movie it's like they're at that one farm, the first farm where like the political activists are, then they have to flee because they realize that they are the ones who killed Julian. So then they have to go to you know, Jasper's place, and then to go to Jasper's place to, you know, and it's like, and there are so many like beautiful shots in this movie of like, you know, like they're driving past like a field and like someone's burning cows, right? There's just like this livestock mountain that's being burned. And it's also just allowing you, in the same way that like in the scenes in London, where you're getting all this like graffiti and billboard, they're getting all this like background information. And like in the same way, the road trip structure kind of allows for like all this background information to also be happening. Yeah, so it's just like, I think it's just like a form that like has a lot of room in it. Like it just like allows all kinds of modes of storytelling, all kinds of genres, you know, and I think it just has this like quality that's very like charming. And like anything can go wrong. Like there's just like a lot of stuff that can happen, you know. I mean, like, and like Children of Men, like the scene, we know one of the most like stressful scenes in that whole movie is when they're trying to escape the farm and the car won't start.
Oh my god.
Pushing the car and they're trying to start it, and like it's so tense. Like my girlfriend was next to me going like, holy shit, oh my god, oh my god, the whole time that scene was happening. And it's like so good because it's like, right, it's like the, like they have to get out of here, the car just won't, the engine won't turn over, and they're trying to like get it to the good speed manually to like finally get a turnover. It's just like, and it's like, yeah, that's the kind of thing where you can have like it, yeah, like the mechanics of it, the delicacy of the machine is like part of the drama or the tension. Or also, I mean, that actually, there's a ton of car, like, because you also have like the scene where Julian dies, right? It's like this whole car chase sequence, or this whole, not, I mean, chase is a strong word, but like the sequence with the car and then like people ambushing them. Like it's, there's so much about the fragility of car, the utility of the car. There's even like a scene where they get pulled over by the cops, which is like obviously very tense and very stressful. So there's just like, yeah, I feel like the road trip as a form is just like kind of an interesting, or as like a, not as a form, as like a structure, I suppose. It's just like an interesting, and has a lot of utility. And I think writers can do a lot with it.
I suppose there's also quite an interesting combination of like confinement plus time that also factors in when we talk about like road trips. Even in some of the kind of quieter scenes in the car in Children of Men, boredom sets in and people volunteer information, or they ask questions that they might otherwise not have asked. And yeah, I love that component of like road trips in films, road trips in fiction. I should ask as well, Carmen, about the idea of location in this movie as like a storytelling asset. There's a line in The Dream House that I think about sometimes. You wrote, "Places are never just places in a piece of writing. If they are, the author has failed. Setting is not inert. It is activated by a point of view." How does that belief about using the environment around your characters when writing a story, how does that apply to Children of Men, do you think? Like, we've already touched on the billboards and the newspapers that help with exposition in the movie. Are there other things that Children of Men does that kind of activate location with a point of view, as you say?
So I think this is actually a way, another sort of feature of this film that is so incredible and I marvel at. I'm sure it's really annoying to watch movies with me because I'm constantly like, it's so good. Just like yelling all the time. But I feel like in Children of Men, something that is so distinct and gorgeous and specific about like the cinematography and about the sort of the film making element of the camera work, I guess, of the movie, is the way the camera both functions to do exactly this, to like animate the landscape, and to also do the opposite, or not do the opposite, but do other work. So basically, like, there are all these moments in the film where the camera is doing this thing. It's like Theo's point of view. So like, for example, there's that scene in the farm where they're all like electing a new leader of this, like, this resistance group or whatever. And so they're like having this election. They're all kind of arguing and fighting in this kitchen. And Theo, and by Theo, I mean the camera, like, looks down at Theo's pant leg, and there's like a kitten like trying to climb his pant leg. And it's like obviously the image of a kitten, so like a baby cat, is like, you know, thematically resonant in the film, but also it's like this huge thing is happening in the scene, but he is looking down at this like little baby kitten trying to climb up his pants. And like, it's in a way, it's like that sort of same echo of this like backgrounding and foregrounding thing, where it's like something really huge is happening in the background, really important sort of narratively speaking, but there's something pulling your attention to like a small detail that's closer, right? And so in that way, it's like, it isn't just, the camera's not just like impartially sort of like gathering information about the politics of this resistance group. It's like actually really interested in like Theo's perspective, right? And so it becomes activated by him, by which I mean the camera. And the camera also does this other really interesting thing, which is it also occasionally shows us things that he's not noticing, which is really interesting. So like, there's a lot of moments in this film, and this is actually true of Y Tu Mama Tambien as well, which is also a movie that has like an actual narrator that's like speaking the whole time, which like is also doing some of this work where it's like both, it's like this sort of omniscient narrator where it's like both telling us things about the characters, but also telling us about like stuff that's in the background that they're not really noticing. So sometimes like the camera will just do other work. So like, for example, the scene where they shoot the police officers and they drive away, the camera follows the car as it turns on the drive, and then it like goes back to this dead man on the ground, and it doesn't quite center them. It kind of like floats near their feet. It's like this really like beautiful shot, and it's so specific. And it's like, so it's like almost like his inattention, or like the thing he's not seeing, is also being animated by the camera. So like, it's this really interesting thing. And again, like, there are ways I can think to do this in writing and in prose, and other ways where I'm like, I don't know what the even equivalent of that would be in prose. But it also reminds me of like, this is going to be like a kind of a jump, but like, or not a jump, it's not a jump at all. What am I saying? Like the, one of my favorite episodes of Buffy the Vampire Slayer, which is The Body, which is, you know, the episode where Buffy's mother dies very suddenly. And it's like a gorgeous, gorgeous episode of television, and there are all these like really crazy shots that are really unlike the rest of the show, where like she's not like an officer comes in and she, or like a emergency responder, and is like talking to her, but the camera is like sitting like kind of here, like at the nose of the responder, so you're not seeing like their full face. It's like she's not looking at their face, but she's looking like, so you're just seeing the camera like suddenly is like really alive with like the perspective and the mindset of this character. And I feel like when that work happens, it's almost like prosody or something. It's like something, it's like when the idea is like, so something in the text is like echoing something really essential about the story or the state of mind of a character or whatever, it creates this really like resonant and interesting effect. And I think the camera is sort of functioning the same way here, where it's like, yeah, it's like showing us both what he's noticing and not noticing. And both of those are giving us like so much information. And it's like a really just tremendous, not even, I call it trick, it's not a trick, but it's like this incredible use of the camera that like I think is so gorgeous and like heartbreaking. And it's just wonderful. It's so good.
I noticed something similar, but using sound. There's one subtle detail that I really like, and it's the slight ringing throughout the movie, it like that's woven into the soundtrack. There's a small moment in like quite early on in the film in which Julianne Moore's character explains after Theo suffers tinnitus after that explosion in the opening scene. She explains that the ringing in your ears after a loud sound is the swan song of the cells in your eardrum dying, and you'll never hear those frequencies again. And to me, like, the way that the soundtrack then takes on that ringing quality, where there is this faint hum, quite high, quite shrill, it all adds to the sense of something dying, of a sense of swan song, a sense of finality to the movie. And yeah, I adore that. I love storytelling when it's sort of transposed to other sensory elements, I suppose.
I love that. I just love that.
So good. But yeah, I mean, we've talked about this film in depth. Are there any other observations about it, Carmen, that I haven't that we haven't broached yet that you'd love to bring up?
I think you've covered so much of it. I also was thinking, you were talking about the road trip thing. I also was thinking about one of my favorite moments in the car, which, and I was also last night end up watching like that feature that I think was from the DVD, which was about how they built that whole rig in that car so they could shoot the like kind of 360, like the way that they shot the characters in that car. They had to like build this like crazy contraption to like do it correctly. And I love stuff like, I love learning about, I'm such a practical effects girly. I'm also the person who's like yelling about CGI constantly. But I feel like just getting, I love getting to see like behind the scenes, how they got a certain shot or whatever. And I think that scene in the car before, you know, they're ambushed and Julian is shot and killed. I mean, and I guess the scene also includes that material, but like when they're doing the like ping pong ball between them. And it's funny because I think the movie does this thing that's so shocking, which is it kills a major character played by a major actress like very, very quickly into the film, which I think is like a really destabilizing thing for a viewer, because you're thinking she's gonna at least be alive for at least most of it, right? And she's dead so quickly. But it's beautiful how in the moments before she dies, like they're having this like back and they're like playing this little intimate game they clearly used to play when they were still together. And it's just such a good detail. It's so quick and so funny. And it like, there's so much stuff happening kind of like between them. And then like he kind of spits at it. Key, and then Key is like, you know, there's just like so much character work happening in that moment. It's just such a good moment. And it was like watching it last night really stood out to me as just being, I don't know, just so beautiful. And of course, coming right before this like horrifying scene where Julianne Moore gets like shot in the neck and blood is just like down her front and she's dead within like seconds. And it's like really horrible. I just feel like there's just such assurance, like there's just such confidence in everything that's happening, which I think is like a thing that I also really have taken from this director, this sort of desire to like, it's like this vision, it's this clarity of vision that I think is like really, and I guess that's what a director is, right? I mean, as I'm saying this, I'm like, that's what all directors are. Most ideally, a director has clarity of vision, I suppose. If you are a bad director, you don't. But like, yeah, like there's this sense of just like confidence and like just committing to these like highs and lows in quick succession and committing to this just audacious like camera work and these audacious sort of choices. And I feel like this is true of, you know, it's also true of Itumama Tambien. It's also really true of A Little Princess. I read somewhere that he built the set, and that's a novel that I really loved as a child. So the movie was like really special to me. And like, I read somewhere that like he built the sets of that movie. So the doorknobs were like a little higher than everything was a little bigger than it was supposed to be. And it was supposed to like kind of emphasize how kind of hostile the setting is to these like little girls who are in this boarding house. And like, I think there's something about that, just like attention to detail, that like audacious camera work, that like really these confident decisions, sort of narrative decisions, like doing things like killing a character off in a way that you're not expecting very suddenly, like that just make him so sort of special and like just make this movie just sing in this way that's like really incredible and really devastating and really moving. And I wish it gave me hope. I wish it was a movie that, you know, gave me a hope about an apocalyptic, a way we soar away from the apocalypse. But ultimately, I think it just makes me feel like I feel his clarity, which I think is like a really specific thing. And like, it just, I don't know, it's really special and I really love it. And I'm really grateful this movie exists. And yeah.
I promise I'm not going to labor on this scene too long because I know we're talking about it a lot, but something you just said really does remind me of, yeah, something amazing about the scene in which Julian dies, right? So the scene that we're describing has like an obvious narrative function. Like Julian is shot, her last dying words implore the protagonist to embark upon this mission to, you know, save the girl. There's now like an emotional imperative for Theo to be embarking on what he's about to embark on, right? Without it, I don't think it plays the same way, right? Like, Theo's fallen into a certain nihilism since his activism days. He is too far down the rabbit hole to save Key simply because, like, he thinks it's the right thing to do. That wouldn't really scan. It wouldn't feel believable. But his ties to Julian, like his lingering love for her, that is enough to make him reluctantly answer the call of this particular cause. So yes, it's a scene that could have just existed as something to drive the narrative forward. It has like a really important role in that regard. Instead though, instead of it just being that, there is this little detail at the beginning of the scene that lifts it into something thematic and poetic too. So before all the chaos breaks loose, Theo and co are, they're in the car, they're listening to the radio, and the radio producer introduces a song with the words, "Now one for all the nostalgics out there, a blast from the past from 2003, that beautiful time when people refused to accept the future was just around the corner." The poetry of that moment, Carmen, like the poignancy of it, is, you know, for these characters, the future really is just around the corner. Like, they're enjoying a sunny moment together, like a playful moment. They're in denial of the terror of their circumstances in that moment. And then, you know, within seconds, they're going to be brutally awoken to the terror all over again when the car is ambushed. There's world building within that small detail. There's foreshadowing too. And it helps the scene, I think, transcend being just another thing that happens within the story, because all of a sudden, instead, the scene feels kind of full of meaning and cruelty and irony and tragedy. And yeah, I just wondered, was that something you noticed? What's your read of that particular creative decision to include that?
I mean, no detail is too small to be overlooked, which I think, you know, when I watch a movie, I mentioned in the beginning how sometimes I come out of movies and I'm so cranky because I'm like just mad about what has just happened, which happens like often. Like, this is, it's hard because even pre-COVID, I was like really struggling to go to the movies because I feel like I would so often go and be like deeply disappointed. But a thing that really makes me crazy is missed opportunities where I'm like, there were a million places that this person could have like reinforced this theme or done this thing, and they just like chose not to, or they didn't do it, or they didn't see it. And it makes me completely crazy. And I feel like the reason I feel that way is because when filmmakers like him are like, it's like no detail is too small. Like, every single beat, every choice, every sound, every shot, everything is so precise. It's like, how could you want anything less after you know that there, if you know that there are people who can do it that way, like, why would you settle for anything less? Yeah. And yeah, it is just exquisite. It's so good.
What do you think of the chances that we might see some of your work on the screen sometime soon? There was an announcement in 2018 that there was an anthology TV series being made of Her Body and Other Parties.
Yes.
I don't know if that's still in the works or if there are other plans.
No. Hollywood is so strange. Obviously, we just came out of this like strike, which is very exciting, or we're coming out of it, I suppose. They're still finalizing the vote. I'm a member of the WGA, so but yeah, that project it's like Holly. It's like, honestly, at this point, I'm like, I don't believe anything unless it's literally, I'm sitting down and watching it. I don't believe that it will happen. I like just ignore it unless it's like literally happening in front of me. I will say I'm in the WGA. I'm working on a bunch of projects. I hope that, you know, they get to happen. I would be really excited if something that I either wrote and was adapted by somebody else, or something that I have written and adapted myself, or something that I have wrote that is not an adaptation ends up on the big screen. It's definitely a goal of mine, thing I'm working at. You know, it's been really interesting because I have been learning like how to write for the screen, which is obviously a totally different animal than writing prose. And it's been like a very, like, it's been a really fascinating kind of learning process, but really fun. And like, really fun to get to think about the work that I really love seeing as a viewer, and then how I might be able to sort of bring that to the screen myself. So maybe one day soon.
That's very exciting. Oh my gosh. My hope is one day I have you back on Script Apart to talk about your new collaboration with Alfonso Cuarón. That would be full circle.
Oh my gosh. Oh, my heart just like skipped a beat when you said that. That would be amazing. If he's listening, hey, hit me up.
Yeah. And in terms of like your non-screenwriting work, your fiction work, is there anything you can tell me about what you've got coming up?
So I am currently working on a book that I was sold right before COVID and then really struggled to work on during COVID because it felt like the world was ending and I was really just not, my mental health was not great. So I'm still working on that. That's kind of the big project I have going on right now, writing wise. So, so working on this new book, it's called A Brief and Fearful Star. Pray for me. I can finish it because it's hard, but yeah, I'm doing my best. So. Yeah.
Is it a natural kind of extension of some of your previous work, or does this feel like a departure?
It's sort of both. So it's a short story. It's a linked short story collection. So it's, still kind of in my wheelhouse. And it's, sort of genre promiscuous work that sort of, it's the stories all center around a comet that is in all the stories that appears in the sky. But also the big sort of departure for me is that this actually came out of a challenge I gave myself years ago, which is that I really want to try to write historical fiction, which was a thing that I was always kind of scared to like write from research. I mean, I wrote a memoir that had a lot of research material, but it's actually really hard to turn like research material into good sentences. And I feel like I kind of started to figure out how to do that with the memoir. And then I was like, I should do this with fiction. So there's a bunch of like historical stories in there that are set like I have a bunch of stories in there that are not contemporary. They're in various parts of history. And that was really fun and kind of exciting. So, but yeah, we'll see.
So exciting.
Thank you.
Gosh, well, I really look forward to reading it, Carmen. And I can't thank you enough for your time today. This has been so fun.
Thank you. Thank you so much. So good to talk to you.
You've been listening to Script Apart. Thank you so much for tuning in. A reminder that if you want to help the show continue to grow, you can join us on Patreon by visiting patreon.com/scriptapart or clicking the link in today's show notes. Thanks again for joining us. We'll see you next time.